Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. I have a great show for you today. Jennifer Gaddis will be joining me. She is the author of The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools. And you know that is an issue that I am very passionate about, so I'm really looking forward to having her on in just a little bit. And I'll tell you more about her when she comes on. But first, I want to share with you some things in the news, some ways you can take action, and of course, share this week's recipe with all of you. So starting with taking some action, or actually, let's talk about what's in the news first. Are we living in a military fascist country? I'm just not recognizing my country anymore. When I read about militia going into Portland and, you know, shooting tear gas into peaceful protesters and throwing people into unmarked vans, it is scary. It makes me think of The Handmaid's Tale. So we just can't relax. We really all need to stay vigilant and proactive and, you know, make sure that we get people out to vote, make sure that mail, voting by mail is safe and secure, and not let our president do anything to break down the U.S. Postal Service, which he is working really hard at doing as well. It's just really, really scary times. And we all need to stay vigilant and do what we can. I'm happy to say that New York State, you know, during this COVID situation, they actually launched a COVID rent relief program. I don't know about other states around the country, but New York did. But, of course, there's just a two-week window, and I only found out about it this week. So there's 1 week left. So I'm sharing that. I shared that in my newsletter out to everybody, and I wanted to let anyone who's listening know that if you are in New York, you have 1 week left to apply for this COVID rent relief program. And, of course, there's, you know, certain criteria that you have to meet in order to qualify for the program. But if you are in need, you should check that out, and that is listed on my website. So I am really scared about what's going to happen when this extra $600 that people have been getting goes away, and all of a sudden we have all these people that can't pay their rent or their mortgage payments, and you know, and people start getting kicked out of their homes. We will have a homeless crisis on our plate, which we already have. So, you know, we're just living through really precarious times, and we all need to do what we can to help our neighbors and our communities. You know, right now with between the COVID happening and unemployment and Black Lives Matters, there's so many issues that are super, super important that we all need to stay aware of and stay safe and support our community and people of color so that they are treated equally and the injustices that plague our nation can be addressed. One thing I would like to encourage you all to do in take action is putting an end to plastic pollution, which is a whole nother issue. It almost seems like, why even bother when we're dealing with all these other immediate issues? But we can't let up on that either. I mean, President Trump is relaxing everything in the environment. Anything good that Obama had put in place, he's undoing. Even, you know, the Clean Air Act and the Water Act that, you know, presidents before Obama put into action, he's trying to undo. So anyway, there is a big push to, and there is a bill that was put into Congress called the Break Free from Plastic Pollution Act. And we are trying to get members of Congress to support that. So you can go onto a website where you can find out who your member of Congress is and ask them to support the Break Free from Plastic Pollution Act. We really need to address this issue as well, because I'm sure you all have heard, I know I have shared it, that we all eat about it. Credit cards worth of plastic a week. It is in our water. It is in our food. It is in our fish. It is in everything, these microbeads that just, you know, that don't even get filtered out in our water system. And if plastic's getting through, you can imagine what else is getting through. So that really needs to happen. And then there's also a Local Farm Act that has been introduced to Congress through Senator Booker, Cory Booker, and we want to get Congress to support this. This is addressing food insecurity. The pandemic has made it much worse. Right now, there's 41 million people who are facing food insecurity, and more than a third of households with children under the age of 18 have reported that their kids are not eating enough because they can't afford the food. And I think I even read that a quarter of all households without children have reported that they don't have enough food. So food security is a real issue, and at the same time, our local small family farmers who depended on selling their crops to schools and farmers markets and institutions and restaurants, they've been struggling to maintain their sales through this pandemic. So this bill will help support the small family farmers as well and not big ag. So please look at my website and undertake action and sign that petition as well. Very important. And now I want to share with you my recipe this week, and I'm really excited. This week I made fonio. How many of you have heard of fonio? Fonio is an ancient grain that has been harvested and been eaten in Africa for over 5,000 years. And I first heard about it years ago, although I had forgotten about it, but Chef Pierre Thyme, who is a chef from Senegal, he was a guest on my show a few years ago, and we talked about the grain fonio and how, you know, it's just unknown here completely. So he started a company where he's importing fonio to stores, and I was able to find it in Whole Foods. So I cooked some up. I made a fonio pilaf with some fresh herbs, sauteed vegetables. I even threw in some raisins that I soaked and some almonds. So it was just really, it was so good. It's similar to couscous. It cooks up really fast, except it's gluten-free, and it's a whole grain. So here you go, fonio pilaf. 1 cup of fonio, and like I said, you can buy it in packages at Whole Foods. And he actually even sells packages of already flavored fonio, but I wanted to, for my first time using it, I really wanted just to use the plain fonio and see what that was like before I doctored it up. So 1 cup of fonio, 2 tablespoons of olive oil, 1 onion, 2 carrots, 1/2 a red pepper, 1/2 a zucchini, 1 teaspoon minced garlic, 1/2 teaspoon salt, 2 cups of boiling water, 1/4 cup of fresh parsley, 1/4 cup of chopped dill, 1/4 cup of almonds, and 1/4 cup of raisins. And I want to let you know that 1 cup of fonio makes 4 cups of cooked grain. 4 cups. So I started by, in a saucepan, I sautéed, or actually used my cast iron pan, I sautéed onions and carrots in olive oil for about 3 minutes until they started getting soft. Then I added the garlic. Then I added peppers and zucchini and sautéed that for another 5 minutes until the vegetables were soft, being careful and mindful not to let the garlic burn. Then while I was doing that, I poured a little boiling water over the 1/4 cup of raisins and let that soak for about 10 minutes just to soften the raisins because I wanted to add to the dish, but I did not want having hard raisins in there. So soaking it just brings out the plumpness and juiciness of the raisins. Then I pushed all the vegetables to the side of the pan, and I added the fonio to the center of the pan and toasted it for 2 minutes. And then I mixed it up with the vegetables and continued sautéing that just for a few minutes. Then I added the boiling water and the salt to the pan and covered it. Reduced the heat and let that just simmer for only 1 minute. That's it. That's right, 1 minute. That's it. Then you turn off the heat and let it sit for another 5 minutes, which, like I said, is very similar to how you do couscous. Let it sit for 5 minutes with the cover on. Then when I took the cover off, that's when I added the parsley, dill, the raisins, the nuts, and I mixed that up, fluffing it up with a fork. I saved a little parsley so I could garnish the top, and that was it. Super easy and super, super delicious. So give it a try. I recommend it, And now it is my pleasure to introduce this week's guest, Jennifer Gaddis. She's the author of the book, The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools. And Jennifer is an assistant professor of civil society and community studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And she got her PhD in environmental studies from Yale University in 2014. Her research on school lunch programs has appeared in numerous journals, including Feminist Economics and the Journal of Agriculture, Food Systems and Community Development, and in popular media outlets such as the New York Times, Washington Post, USA Today, and Teen Vogue. And for me, as a person who's worked with school lunch for so long and is very involved with local farms and school food, it's such a pleasure to invite Jennifer on. Jennifer, you with me?
Yes. Thank you so much for having me this morning.
Sure. So did I pronounce your last name right?
You did. Thank you.
Great. Okay. So I thought maybe we could start by you just giving my listeners an overview of the history of school lunch, because it has not always existed. So maybe you could share a little background with everyone first.
Sure. So often people will hear that the National School Lunch Program in the U.S. started in 1946, right after the end of World War II, as a way to really combat child poverty and child malnutrition that was discovered particularly among recruits during World War II, so as part of this kind of national defense idea of making sure that we had a population that was really well nourished. But the story that I actually tell in the book goes back about 50 years before that, to the 1890s, at a point when public education, particularly for young kids, was really just becoming something that was required by law. And there were a lot of reformers, women in particular, who really felt like it was important to make sure that the food that kids were able to access at schools was nutritious. And there was also this concern about safety of food and needing to have people who really were trained to make sure that they could tell, you know, if food had been adulterated or if it was fraudulent in other kinds of ways. So a lot of the same concerns about child nutrition and safety, and also just kind of the challenges of preparing meals for children at home and making sure that they stay good by the time children were to eat them, you know, 5 or 6 hours later at lunchtime, that parents might still feel today, were some of the early motivations in the 1890s for some of the first penny lunch programs that we had in the U.S. And really from there, it took about 50 years of experimentation at the local level and some massive scale up during the Great Depression for us to eventually get to a point in the 1940s where we really had this local and state infrastructure already of not-for-profit school lunch programs that then sort of became codified into this national, like federally controlled program.
Mm-hmm. And when you say nationally controlled, does the federal government provide the food for the National School Lunch Program?
The way it works now is the federal government provides for any school that participates in the National School Lunch Program and or the National School Lunch School Breakfast Program, they provide two things based on participation numbers. So they'll provide a reimbursement, and the amount that they'll provide for reimbursement is different depending upon whether a kid qualifies for free lunches, reduced price lunches, or a paid lunch. So any lunch that's actually served or breakfast through either of these federal programs is subsidized with some amount of cash that's reimbursed to the local school food service department. And schools also, based on those participation numbers, get a certain allocation of what are called commodities dollars. So earlier on in the school lunch program, it used to be that, you know, schools would get these commodities donations, and it was the U.S. Department of Agriculture and their sort of ag economists who would decide, you know, what do we have a surplus of? Like, we'll send that to the schools, like kind of regardless of, you know, whether or not it was really even things that were widely used in school meal preparation. But things have changed, and these days schools have a lot more choice in terms of what they actually choose to purchase with their commodities dollars. So typically the state level administrator for the school lunch program will get some sort of list of the things that are available on the national level, and then they'll decide sort of what items to offer at the state level. And a lot of school districts, because of kind of the complexities of how the commodities program works, will try to maximize the value of those commodities dollars. And a lot of them will end up spending quite a bit of their commodities allocations on what are called center of the plate items. So things like chicken nuggets and hamburger patties and things like that, that would be a little bit more costly for the districts to be purchasing on their own. Schools oftentimes Hello? Also serve items that are a la carte. Sorry, my phone cut out for just a second. Schools often will serve like items that are not part of the federal school lunch and breakfast program. And those items are called a la carte items. And those are things that typically aren't regulated in quite the same way in terms of their nutritional content. And those items are not reimbursable at all, in large part because they aren't subject to the same kinds of nutritional regulations as the food that kids would be getting if they go through a regular cafeteria line. But those a la carte dollars are actually really important for the schools that have a la carte lines. And so one of the things that we're seeing right now with COVID-19 and the pandemic causing the school shutdowns is that a lot of these school lunch programs that are essentially not-for-profit programs operating in schools, and they're sort of expected to be financially self-sustaining units within the school infrastructure. What we're seeing is that a lot of them are just really, really struggling because they have a lot of fixed costs. And during the pandemic with the school closures, even though a large number of schools continued to really make a huge effort to get food to kids, particularly kids who would be more reliant on the free and reduced price meals, they're really missing out on the group of kids who would be accessing those paid meals and also the a la carte meals, so more of the like upper middle class and middle class students in public schools. So without that revenue, a lot of school districts are really kind of, I think, in a bad place financially right now with their lunch programs.
Absolutely.
So there's a lot of lobbying going on right now to try to get the federal government to really help with that financial problem and also move to a universal free model of school provisioning for this upcoming academic year.
As far as a la carte items, though, as in my school district, which is not mine, but the one that I work in, which is Glen Cove City Public School. Even though the a la carte items are not reimbursable, they still have to meet certain standards. They have to have a certain amount of, or they're not allowed to have a certain amount of salt or sugar or fat. They do have some regulations, and one of the things that is so tricky is that they might be cut back. They might cut back on the salt for the school Fritos, let's say. But if a kid goes to a store and buys Fritos because they similar packaging, the one in the store, so often the kids are have loyalty or name recognition. They want the same thing, and the ones in the store are not limited. And a lot of times also when they take out the salt, they add more sugar in order to compensate for the lack of flavor. So, I have found that.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, that's a really big problem. And for those who really haven't followed school nutrition policy very closely, that was a change that was enacted during the 2014-2015 school year. It was something called the Smart Snacks Rule. And really, I think before that point, there wasn't federal legislation that provided nutrition standards for those a la carte items. I think individual school districts have long used wellness policies to kind of put stricter nutrition standards on a la carte, but there wasn't any kind of federal rule until 2014. And I think at that point, what we saw is exactly what you're describing, which is manufacturers, still wanting to have their branded products in schools because it's a great place for them to kind of, reach a young audience and hook them in terms of brand loyalty. Right. And, you know, what a lot of them did was essentially reformulate in ways that don't necessarily comply with, you know, what a lot of people would view as being nutritious, like you said, you know, substituting sugar for salt. Like if we look overall holistically, you know, at the item, it's like maybe it's better in some areas, but it's certainly not, I think, as good as it could be. And the big issue there too is a term that some people may have heard and others not is copycat snacks. So that's something that a lot of people like within the public health community have been really critical of, is this idea of these manufacturers using the same brand logos and sometimes even having the exact same like named products in schools. And then those healthier versions of the products aren't even available in the commercial retail environment. So, you know, even if families wanted to have the healthier version that's served in schools, it's not accessible. So when people are going to shop and buy their own food, what they're actually getting is, you know, a product that is largely going to be cheaper for the manufacturer to produce, but less healthy for the consumer.
Mm-hmm. I've also seen where, you know, they've just made the packages a little smaller to meet the standards.
Right.
But kids will go in and buy four packs, you know, and sit down to, you know, instead of buying lunch, they sit down to like four bags of Doritos or something like that, you know. And I mean, there's no criteria for the artificial flavors or colors or preservatives or any of that stuff. I mean, it's just salt or sugar or so.
Yeah, and interestingly, like when I started doing research for this book, it was in like 2010, I believe. And I remember going, the first time I went to the big national food show that the School Nutrition Association puts on, lots and lots of food service directors around the country come to that, and you know, manufacturers will show them their new products and kind of talk about things and try to get them, you know, to, you know, buy whatever branded version of products that they have for their school cafeterias. And in the summer of 2012, I remember being there, and everyone was just sort of like, you know, freaked out about the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act of 2010 and those regulations going into effect that upcoming school year, and how that meant, you know, all these changes in terms of the sodium content and whole grain requirements and things of that nature. But then when I went back a few years later, it seemed like much more of the conversation among manufacturers had really shifted in this direction of what people tend to refer to as clean labels. So exactly like that rhetoric that you're just talking about in terms of, you know, removing like high fructose corn syrup and artificial colors and flavoring and things of that nature. And it really seemed like a lot of manufacturers were trying to at least have, you know, one item in their product portfolio that they could really point to as like, you know, see, like we're doing this really good thing. We're serving like clean food in schools. And don't worry, you don't need to, you know, build out kitchen infrastructure or hire workers in full-time positions. Like we can deliver all the health benefits that people who, you know, might be talking about real food or clean food in schools are demanding, you know, without actually really changing a lot of the power structure, the way that things are actually like kind of flowing through these mega corporations into schools. So that's something that in the book I refer to as real food light, and I really kind of argue against that approach as being an endpoint in terms of what school food reform should look like.
Right, right. I remember being shocked. You know, they called me the food police back when my kids were in the public school. This was before they even changed the school, the healthy school lunch program, and, you know, improved a little. I mean, after I had left, they started making it where you could, you know, they lightened up on the procurement so that you could actually get some local vegetables from a local farm. It didn't necessarily have to be the cheapest bid you could get. You know, you could spend a little more and buy local. But prior to that, I remember going in and looking at the ingredients, because we had really worked hard to try to improve the school lunch program by writing in all these requirements, but we still were dealing with a big food service manufacturer, provider, Aramark, who you mentioned in your book too. And
oh,
anyway, so they had the French fries were just like the lawsuit from McDonald's. The French fries were had beef flavoring in them. You know, they spray the French fries before freezing them with beef fat so that when they're cooked, they have that flavor. And I was furious because My kids are vegetarian.
Yeah.
And, you know, and those hidden ingredients that people don't even think of. And I know in your book, you know, you talk about the Aunt Jemima syrup, or not even, we don't even have the Aunt Jemima. We have a cheaper one than that. Although Aunt Jemima will be history. I hear they're changing the name for Aunt Jemima finally. But anyway, you know, trying to get real maple syrup, forget it. You know, it's just not happening. And meanwhile, there's, you know, showing the, you know, the French toast sticks that they're putting out at the school lunch as being healthy. And I actually looked at the ingredients and they were not, I wanted to complain. You know, I went in, I was like, I can't believe you're serving these French toast sticks. They looked like yellow, like they had artificial color in them, and but they didn't. I was surprised. They didn't have artificial color. They, of course, had, you know, I guess a little turmeric in them for some yellow. And you know, they had egg and, you know, the things that you would think are would be in French toast. So the French toast sticks themselves weren't that bad. But the syrup that they were serving with it was poison. And it's just infuriating. You know, it's like when they put out a salad bar with fresh vegetables and then they put, you know, some, I forget the names of those big gallons of like Russian dressing and ranch dressing that are so unhealthy. You know, and they put those out on the salad bar. So we've got a lot of work to do, right?
I think you raised some really important points, and, you know, I'll just touch on a few of them in response. So you mentioned that the school that you had worked with was outsourced Aramark, and that's something that I think a lot of people don't necessarily realize how widespread that practice is or how controversial it was in the beginning. So the best estimates that I've seen show that about 17 to 20% of school districts at this point in time have outsourced their food service department to these private for-profit management companies. So the big three, as they're known, are Aramark, Chartwell's, and Sodexo. And these companies typically have contracts not only with K-12 schools, which are probably their least profitable market, but also with colleges and universities and prisons and other kinds of institutional food service. And one of the ways that they are really able to, I would say, like, find profit in a not-for-profit program is by relying on their close relationships with big food manufacturers and, you know, having these contracts where they're really buying in such high volume that they're able to get you know, cheaper food for the schools. But I would say that, you know, that is a problem if we're thinking at all about trying to create more community-centered or resilient or, you know, eco-friendly kinds of food systems, because that model really just, I would say, reinforces kind of big factory centralized production versus the kind of like farm-to-school programs or geographical kind of preference that you were talking about earlier. So there's been this real movement for what's called value-centered procurement. And I think that, you know, that could mean a lot of things in different places in terms of the priorities that communities hold about how they want to use like their public school food dollars to support different kinds of food systems. But when you have outsourced to a company like Aramark or Chartwell's or Sodexo, you lose a lot of decision-making power as the district, I would say. And the other kind of main area where these private management companies tend to find profit is really in reducing labor costs. Oftentimes, you know, once they have contracted with a district, they're able to hire food service employees directly through the management company instead of through the school district. So they are able to do a lot more sort of creative things to reduce wages and benefits. And, you know, that's something that really degrades job quality in communities around the country. So I kind of think that, you know, in some cases, yes, these management companies might be bringing a certain level of efficiency or expertise, but it does tend to come at a cost to communities. And then the other thing that I would say is, you know, part of the reason why these companies became really prevalent in the first place, they weren't even allowed in schools until 1970. It was something that a lot of the kind of early founders of these not-for-profit school lunch programs really cautioned against doing. One of the big reasons why they were allowed into schools was because they promised to basically delivers like cheaper, better services. And I think that throughout the history of school food in the United States, like we've always expected both food and care for children to be cheap. And that cheapness really comes at a cost. So one of the big things that I try to do both in the book and in my more public scholarship is really to try to get people to rethink like these hidden costs of cheapness and to imagine what really could be possible in terms of generating public value if we were to use our school food programs differently.
Mm-hmm. You know, when you talk about cheapness, I think, you know, across the board, it's almost like we don't value our children the way we should. I mean, you know, we're also looking for daycare centers should be cheap. You know, they, you know, paying for watching our kids are cheap. I mean, people pay more to have their dog walked than they're willing to pay for someone to care for their child, you know, and it's, you know, it's just, and teachers, you know, we just are not valuing what's the things I think that are so important. You know, I joke about, well, I don't joke, but I, you know, my daughter who has a PhD who, you know, works in a museum makes half of what, you know, her brother makes who, you know, just has an undergraduate degree, but he's in sales, you know. And so it's just what's valued in this country is just, you know, backwards. And I don't know where we start to change that around. But the school lunch and school food, and as we know, nutrition is so important and getting the nutrition back into the school. So often you talk about the lunch ladies, and, you know, people always joke about lunch ladies. And they're critical characters both in, you know, the feminist history of the school lunch program. Can we talk a little bit about, you know, the school lunch lady, and are they real, imagined? You know, what, I mean, I could certainly add some to that, but let's talk about what you write in your book about the school lunch ladies.
Sure. So one of the things that I would say is that there's this sociologist, Ashley Vancel-Leap, whose work I read that really, I think, shaped a lot of my thinking in terms of just some of the observations that I had when I was spending time in kitchens and cafeterias across the country doing research for this book. And what she did was she actually looked at representations of lunch ladies in popular media, so things like, you know, Adam Sandler and like The Simpsons and stuff like that. And what she found is that there's actually kind of two ways in which lunch ladies are portrayed. And at first it seems really contradictory, but then it kind of makes sense. So the two ways are the mother and the witch. So in some portrayals, like the lunch ladies is like very, very nurturing, feminine presence who, you know, provides comfort to kids through food and through interpersonal interaction. And in the other archetype, the lunch lady is this like nasty looking, mean woman who serves like food that's like, you know, you probably shouldn't even classify it as food. So like this question of like how these two archetypes like seem to coexist together is something that I really wanted to dig into a little bit more deeply. And, you know, when I would talk to people about my experiences with cafeteria workers who just really cared so much about the kids that they were feeding and who would make sacrifices, you know, sometimes using like their own wages to cover the cost of student meals, like sometimes, you know, just coming in early or working late to make sure, you know, they're not being paid for their time, but they knew that the work needed to be done in order to really meet the kids' needs. Like I saw so many examples of workers going above and beyond, or, you know, refusing to stand up for their own like labor rights because they were worried about how that in the short term could potentially have negative impacts on the kids. So I was seeing kind of all these positive stories that I wanted to reclaim and highlight. But then I would also talk with people and, you know, go to cafeterias where there would be people, typically not so much like the lunch ladies, but more so like cafeteria monitors, just like screaming at kids through a megaphone. And I certainly saw, you know, cafeteria workers not always being like the nicest to kids. And what I really came to as a conclusion is that I think for the most part, the people who come into this job really do care about kids. Otherwise, they don't stay in a job. It's not a well-paid position at all. So nationally, I believe that the hourly wage is just a little under $11 an hour. And what makes it kind of even worse is that in the majority of schools that use what's called like the heat and serve model, where instead of cooking meals from scratch using fresh ingredients, you're basically just getting in stuff that's been cooked elsewhere and you're reheating it at the school site. You know, when that's your model of food preparation, you don't need full-time workers, or the number that you need is relatively small. What you need a lot of are people in the 2 to 5 hour positions that typically would not be benefit level positions in school districts. So that really means that, you know, people who are staying in those short hour positions, they're certainly not, you know, staying there because it's this like excellently, you know, paid position. For a lot of people, it's actually a struggle to continue, you know, doing that work, but they feel committed to the kids that they are caring for. But, you know, for some workers, it's like, okay, I'm not getting benefits after this job. I have to go to my second job or even my third job. You know, these kids are being really disrespectful to me. I don't feel supported, you know, by like management. And I'm doing like really like hard work, you know, interacting with kids, like, because actually working like in a school kitchen or cafeteria is a lot harder, I think, than most people imagine, just in terms of both the physical labor and also the emotional labor. So I think for some workers, it can start to feel just, you know, really like alienating and disempowering that, you know, they are showing up and for what, and especially in contexts where they don't really have a lot of decision-making power in terms of how the kids are actually being like brought into the cafeteria, or, you know, what the management looks like. And in particular, I talked to a lot of workers who really disagreed with the policies that their local school districts had surrounding how unpaid meal debt was handled. And if they had to do something that they considered shaming of the kid, for instance, like throwing away their lunch tray or giving them a cold cheese sandwich instead of like a regular cafeteria meal. Those are things that really weighed on a lot of the workers emotionally in terms of, you know, how they would be harming the kids. So I do think that there can also be this phenomenon where, you know, otherwise caring workers through like the environment and the conditions of their jobs start to become really alienated over time. And then that's kind of how we get to this point of, you know, not having the nicest like workers in the world as a subset of like the cafeteria workforce. But I think that the story that I really want to tell in the book is much more kind of highlighting all the different ways in which cafeteria workers do much more for kids than most people give them credit for. And I also really want to try to bring to the conversation just this idea of what's actually possible when we start to like transition more and more of these jobs to full-time instead of part-time. And when we start to empower cafeteria workers as, you know, educators, and to recognize them for doing the kind of emotional and care work that so many of them want to do for kids in our schools. But
yeah,
I think that,
oh, that would be so amazing. You know, it's like I was brought in as the farm-to-school coordinator, but with the goal of trying to help the school transition into more scratch cooking. But it's like you don't know where to start because, as you said, the majority of them are part-time. They, you know, the school district doesn't really want to give them more hours and have to give them the benefits. But right now, their time is full just unpackaging the boxes, laying things out on sheet pans, you know, putting canned fruit cocktail into 4 ounce cups for the portion control. You know, it's just busy work, you know, work that really anybody can do. Where, and the reality is, the majority of the women that are in the cafeteria I work from, they're from Italy. They're great chefs.
Oh, interesting.
I mean, you know, they're home cooks, but they absolutely could do what needs to happen for scratch cooking, but they can't with the amount of time that they have. They are busy from the minute they get there to the minute they leave, just in putting together the frozen food that they're defrosting, laying it out. I mean, it's just, it's unbelievable. I want to hear how you address it in the book, but let's take a couple minute break. And when we come back, I'd love to talk about how we could fix school food, your dream, and, you know, and scratch cooking, and how we can actually help to make that happen and There's so much in your book. It's just so wonderful. So everyone who's just joining us, I'm talking with Jennifer Gaddis about her book, The Labor of Lunch. And don't go anywhere. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Gary Null, and I'm happy to be just one of the many voices speaking truth to power every day on the Progressive Radio Network. We have dozens and dozens of the finest minds in the United States, people who have spent their careers helping, first and foremost, bring justice to issues. Ralph Nader, Jimmy Dore, Gerald Salante, Utrice Lee. From all communities, we look at what is the truth. We are not right. We are not left. We're not card-carrying members of any party. We may have been at one time, but today we're just looking to how we can cut through all of the nonsense. Occam's razor, the philosophy of cut through it and get to the truth of it. And generally, it is the most direct and honest answers, and that's what we seek. Because progressivism is to seek the truth without having to first monitor with some ideological identity. No, the truth doesn't need an ideological identity. It just needs good spokespersons to bring it to you. And we have that at the Progressive Freedom Network. We challenge Big Pharma. We challenge the big industries like Monsanto and DuPont. We challenge Wall Street and the banking community and the energy cartels, nuclear, and high gas hydrofracking. We challenge all of them every day, 24/7. This is a place to come if you can handle the truth.
PRN. Progressive Radio Network.
Progressive Radio Network. The Thinking Person Station.
Stay tuned for more cutting-edge viewpoints on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
This is PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm talking with Jennifer Gaddis about her book, The Labor of Lunch. And we were just getting ready to talk about real school food, how we can fix the school food and get our cafeteria ladies to do some scratch cooking. So, Jennifer, where do we start?
So it's a really big question, but I will say the title of my book kind of, I think, gives away where I think we need to start, which is actually focusing on like the labor and labor structure of how school food is prepared in the United States. Some of the research that I've done has also been international in countries that really do a ton of scratch cooking and serve a lot of local food in their schools. And something that I've really, I think, noticed about the conversation in the U.S., particularly when I started this research in 2010, was that, you know, there seemed to be all this energy around farm to school programs, so starting school gardens and sourcing food locally, and this conversation about getting healthier food into schools. But at the time, it really seemed like there wasn't a ton of discussion, at least in academic or policy circles, about the need to really invest in labor. So by that, I mean the equipment and the time and the infrastructure and the people necessary to actually like transform raw ingredients into finished like cooked school meals. And I saw so many schools when I was traveling around the country for my fieldwork that, you know, really cared about trying to support local farmers and get local food into their schools, but they were pretty limited in terms of what they could do. They might be able to, you know, for a few months out of the year, serve some raw vegetables on their salad bar, but without the ability to actually be cooking in their school sites, you know, it's hard for them to do a whole lot more than that, or maybe, you know, serve an apple or a peach or an orange, whatever
right,
it is
right.
that maybe grows locally for the fruit component. So I started to really see that the schools that were cooking from scratch were able to do so much more in terms of sourcing food locally and controlling the kinds of ingredients that went into the food. You mentioned earlier, you know, some of these chemicals that are, you know, just in packaged processed foods, like, you know, across the whole food system. And I think that schools, once I think that we really need to be focusing on just generating what I call community-based culinary capacity. So the actual ability to cook from scratch. And I think that that also, you know, can help us in terms of addressing some of the racial justice aspects of what's going on in public schools, where, you know, there's a lot of criticism of the dietary standards and what's served in school cafeterias as really being, you know, a reflection of whiteness and white supremacy, particularly, you know, if we look at milk, like cow's milk is the only reimbursable beverage in like federal school meals, but we have so many, you know, students who are lactose intolerant. And some schools may offer some sort of alternative to kids that is a non-dairy milk, but, you know, that tends to be more expensive for them. And
yeah, I haven't,
you know,
seen any school
meat
that I know that has a dairy alternative. And they won't allow water either, which people have asked.
Yeah. So I think that there, you know, there are a lot of things that really don't align particularly well in terms of meeting the needs of communities and the diversity of, you know, what the student population actually looks like in our public schools today. So I think if we were to move to this model of actually having more community control through scratch cooking, it would really create a lot more abilities for us to have school food programs that really reflect and celebrate you know, the diversity that exists in schools today. But if you don't have scratch cooking, you can't do that, because most of these, like, big manufacturers, they want to make, you know, the least offensive product to the, you know, most people so they can easily sell it to the national market. So I think that focusing on scratch cooking is a really important thing. And with scratch cooking, an added benefit is that you really start to create more of these full-time jobs for people. So one of the districts that I spent a lot of time in is Minneapolis Public Schools. And I think that they're a really good example of a place that had prepared basically a little pre-packed kind of TV dinner style meals in a central kitchen, and then started to build like on-site kitchens at all of their schools. And they started to see, you know, that teachers and kids and so many more people were actually eating once they moved to this model of on-site production and really like amped up their like real food efforts. They were able to convince the school board to invest in expanding that model across the whole district. And I think something that they've really seen is that they are able to recruit and retain staff, you know, at a much better rate than most school food service operations. And the kinds of jobs that they're offering people allow them to actually stay in those jobs longer and to only have one job instead of two or three. And one of the reasons why I think that's important, I mean, I think we should care about labor no matter what and people's ability to live. But if we're thinking about this just kind of from the public health investment of school food, a lot of the research on taste and taste formation shows that it's really important for kids to feel like they're in a safe environment and that they have like a trusted, well-liked person when they're being introduced to new foods that might be unfamiliar. So if you have a lot of turnover, particularly, you know, in these shorter hour positions in the, like the lunch line or like, you know, the cashiers, what you end up having is just a lot of like adults sort of rotating through the kids' lives. And it's harder for them to, you know, feel like, oh, you know, I really like and trust like this cafeteria worker. So even though this like food item maybe looks weird to me, like I'll trust her, like I'll try it. Like it's a lot harder, you know, for them to have that sense of trust or to feel like, oh, I didn't really like that. And I can just, you know, be honest with this person and, you know, give feedback. So I think that, you know, really having that relationship is actually very important if we're thinking about using school food programs as a space in which we're introducing, you know, kids to a wider range of food than they might be able to get in their home environment. And there's been some studies that really show that particularly for low-income families, it's risky, you know, buying foods that your kids aren't necessarily familiar with because you can't necessarily afford for them to, you know, reject whatever you're offering them the like six or eight or more times it takes for them to, you know, like develop more of a liking for that food if they ever do. So in some ways, like the school lunch program can play this really important role in really reducing the financial risk, particularly for low-income families in terms of introducing kids to different kinds of fruits and vegetables and other foods. So you asked this question of how do we fix it? I think investing in labor, and one of the I think we also need to invest in having our school food program actually be treated as a part of like the educational enterprise of public schools.
Yes.
So I think the places that I've gone that have universal school lunch programs in which everyone participates are a lot higher. And in the U.S., we have about 30 million kids every day who participate in the National School Lunch Program in ordinary times, not necessarily pandemic times, and about another 20 million kids who have this program in their school but who opt out. So they either buy something from the a la carte line, or if they have the ability to leave campus, they might do that, or they bring a lunch from home. So those 20 million kids who are opting out are disproportionately from upper middle class and middle class families. And I wrote about this actually, I think in February, in an op-ed for the New York Times. And the big argument that I'm making there is that essentially, like, when we have all of these upper middle class and middle class, kids opting out of the program, it makes it really, really difficult for us to ever generate the political will to truly invest in this program in the way that we need to, because I think for a lot of the upper middle class and middle class families whose kids aren't participating in the program, it's sort of out of sight, out of mind. They might think about it sometimes in terms of it, you know, being something that maybe their kids eat every once in a while, or they might have like a realization of the importance of the free and reduced price meal program, but it's not like going to be necessarily a priority for them to, you know, talk to their school board or talk to like their legislators at the state or federal level and really try to make this program change. So I think that a lot of the places that I've been that do have universal school meal programs, they're able to do so much more in terms of actually treating school lunch as an educational like part of the school day, because everyone's participating. So you can actually treat it like a class. And I think that we don't have the same kind of, I think, lack of public investment in these countries that have universal school meal programs.
Can you share which countries, had good models for you?
There's a lot of countries that have models that are good in terms of what you see like just in individual cafeterias, but I think that the countries that have really great national programs, in my mind, are the ones that have universal school meals, meaning that all kids participate, and I especially like the ones that are universal free, meaning that they're using tax revenue essentially to provide free meals to everyone versus charging like a different rate at point of service. And those that are really using their school lunch programs to support a transition to more sustainable forms of agriculture and food production. So the ones that I think like really fit that model, I would say South Korea is doing an amazing job. In 2011, they created something called the Universal Free Eco-Friendly School Lunch Program. And it's actually been so successful in terms of really catalyzing a transition to eco-friendly farming in the country, that the Korean government wants to replicate that model across its other public food programs, which actually feed about a quarter of the population. So like when you start to use public food programs in that way, I think that it becomes really transformative in terms of what public food programs can actually do across like the whole sort of domestic food system. I think Japan has a really amazing model, and I've actually done field work there already in terms of how they handle like food education. And that's something that in Japan really, I think, changed a lot in 2005 when something called the Basic Law of Shokuiku, which means food education, was passed. And it was really at that point that a lot of the kind of national resources devoted to food education started being funneled into the schools. And schools saw a lot of investment in terms of just the people that were employed there who really got to focus on designing like nutrition and like home economics education for the students there. I think Finland also has a really amazing model. They've actually had universal free school meals since 1940s, so they've done it for a long time. And they're also using a lot of their school food programs to support organic agriculture. And then I think that as far as more kind of global South countries go, Brazil has a really interesting model because they not only have universal free school meals in all of their public schools, but they actually have a law that says that schools that participate in this national program have to source at least 30% of their ingredients from like smaller scale family farmers. So they're really trying to support land tenure and the ability for people to stay on the land and food sovereignty through like that baseline threshold. And that's very different from the U.S. where we sort of say, hey, it's great if you participate in a farm-to-school program, but it's certainly not required. And, like, right now, most of the additional money that schools would get for doing local sourcing or for, you know, privileging smaller-scale farmers is something that they would get through a grant mechanism, whether it's like a USDA farm-to-school grant or a grant from some sort of private foundation. It's not something, with the kind of rare exception of there's a few states that have like a 10 cent per meal kind of incentive. But most places, you don't really get like, I would say a strong like regulatory like incentive to be doing this kind of sourcing. So there is.
No, you don't. And even my school grant, I am paid through the New York State Farm to School Grant Program. It does not cover food. It's a grant program for farm to table, but it's supposed to encourage scratch cooking. And there's money in there to buy new equipment if we need new equipment, pay my salary, do some training to the staff. But it does not pay for food and local procurement. So, you know, I have to buy vegetables from New York State, but the school district has to pay for that. And the school district doesn't necessarily want to pay for that. So it's
right.
It's really, you know,
so that's,
not in
that's
a good
where
place.
I would encourage. Sorry, I was just going to say, I know we're probably at time, but that's where I would really encourage people to support the Universal School Meals Act. So this was introduced in October by Ilhan Omar and Bernie Sanders. And what I really, really love about this act and why I would encourage your listeners to be vocal about supporting it is that it would not only convert the U.S. National School Lunch Program into a universal model, but also increase the reimbursement rate of what schools are getting based on each meal that they serve. So they'd actually have more money to cover like the cost of labor for scratch cooking. And importantly, it sets an incentive mechanism where any school district that sources at least 30% of food locally would get an extra I think it's actually 30 cents. I might be wrong on the, I can't remember the exact amount.
Well, I know New York State does have that also, where if we got 30% of our, sourced 30% of our food from New York State, they would get a big reimbursement that would make up for the extra food cost. But the one thing that would put us up into that range would be being able to get milk from New York State, but there's no milk. There is no milk in New York State available on Long Island that's distributed to Long Island that in those little cartons that we can get. It's just, you know, I've looked into
it. It's so complex.
It is. It's so
like
frustrating.
Most of these
so
barriers,
frustrating.
You would never imagine them until you encounter them.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, I think that's the other thing with this being a national program is that there's so much local variation. So I think that there's a lot of stuff that needs to be figured out, but I think until we really have a lot of political will to be investing the necessary resources into this program, it's going to be hard to really transition to a different model. So that's where, along with my book, I did develop a community reading guide to help people kind of have some understanding of how to organize around these issues, both
will you send that to me and I will share
level.
It? Send that to me, and I'll share it on my website newsletter, because we are, believe it or not, out of time. I'm going to have you come back, because we didn't touch on so many things that I want to talk about. So maybe I can get you to come back sometime soon.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed chatting with a kindred spirit about the issues. So thank you so much,
and thank you for your work. It's just so, so important. And everybody out there who's been listening, I've been talking with Jennifer Gaddis. Get her book, The Labor of Lunch. Educate yourself about the school lunch program and help us support this Universal Free School Meal Act. I'm so excited to hear about that. So have a great rest of the week, everyone. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green, and I will see you again next week. Bye for now.